सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार। वी हैव एडेड एन इंग्लिश एडिशन टू सोच विचार। वी डू दिस बिकॉज वी फील दैट फर्स्ट इकोनॉमिक डिस्कोर्स especially learning in economics must be conducted in English because all research and empirical evidence is available in English. The second reason is that we wish to include our donor partners who make much of our policy in this discussion. We welcome them to join us. We want them to comment and participate, even do episodes with us. After all, Soch Pichar means thought and analysis. Today, I'm very proud to let you know that I have Mr. Khalid Ikram here with us. Khalid Ikram is one of our prominent economists, one of our most capable economists, who has a long history with both Pakistan and the rest of the world, and I'll tell you how. Khalid was educated in Cambridge and then got a PhD from Harvard. He joined the Planning Commission in 1962. So you can assume that he has a very close relationship with the Planning Commission and he knows Pakistan's planning and economic history very well. And that is the reason for talking to Khalid. But Khalid's history does not just stop there. He was with the Planning Commission on the ground floor, working on the, I think, first and second five-year plan. And then even the third five-year plan. But then he left the Planning Commission when things were deteriorating, and we'll talk to him about that. And he went to the World Bank in 1975, where he had an illustrious career. He worked in East Asia and Egypt and was regarded as one of the World Bank's finest. He worked for a few years in the finance department of the World Bank too. But very important to mention that Khalid Ikram got a gold medal from Korea on his contributions to development in Korea, which is a rare achievement. Then Khalid went on to work in Egypt, and he's written two books on Egypt, and the third one is in the press. So he's an Egyptian expert too. Khalid brings to us a wide variety of experience, and we can learn from him. So Khalid Saab, welcome.
Thank you very much, Nadeem. It's always a pleasure to be with you, and on this podcast, it's an honor to be with you.
Thank you, Khalid Saab. Khalid Saab, can we begin by trying to recall the Planning Commission when you joined it? I believe it was an elite institution then, and you must have been quite excited. What was the atmosphere like out there, and what did the Planning Commission do then? We still look back to those glory days.
Well, I think that the main differences between the Planning Commission at that time and the Planning Commission today is first the general environment, because the focus was on economic development. I mean, in a sense, what was happening was that you had Ayub Khan, who had become the president, and of course he was a military man who had taken power, and I think he was trying to legitimize his regime by providing economic development. This is a common thing. I mean, the Koreans did the same thing, the Taiwanese did the same thing, and I mean, many other countries have sought to legitimize non-democratic rule by providing security and economic development. So that, I think, was pretty much in Ayub Khan's mind, and economic development was made principal focus of his government. The second thing was that because Pakistan was a young country, I mean, I'm talking about 1962, we'd been in existence only for 15 years, there was a tremendous sense of idealism over there. And a lot of people who could have made much more money in other places were drawn to work for the Planning Commission and for other parts of other areas where they could feel that they could do service to Pakistan. I mean, for example, at that time, when I joined the Planning Commission, my salary was 600 rupees a month, and I paid tax on that. I mean, people now laugh when I tell them this. And at the same time, I mean, I had come back with a very good degree from Cambridge. And people who, in my position, were joining private firms where they were earning, well, comfortably 6, 7, 8 times as much. I had, of course, could not afford a car, and I could not even afford an apartment or a flat or anything. So I was living with my aunt and later on in the government hostel. And every morning one had to line up outside the road waiting for a rickshaw to take you to work. Sometimes it would take 20 minutes before you found a rickshaw. Sometimes it would take close to an hour.
But I mean, you didn't have a car, because now everybody has a car in the planning commission.
No, I didn't have a car at all. I mean, this is...
A government-provided car.
No, I didn't have any car at all, private or government or something. I couldn't afford to buy one. And 500 rupees, 600 rupees a month minus tax, I couldn't afford to run it even if I had a car. So one of the motorcycle rickshaws was all that I could afford to go to work. And then after a while, Javed Asfar joined the planning commission and he had a car. So he would drop me back home. I mean, this is partially solved the problem of my getting back. But getting to work still required waiting from 20 minutes to an hour on the road outside waiting for an empty rickshaw. But we, none of us felt this was an imposition. We felt that we were doing work that was good and that was contributing to the country's betterment.
So there was a missionary spirit.
We would call it almost that, but it was also a fun spirit. I mean, Javed Hamid, Javed Asfar, Shahid Amjad Chaudhary, me, you know, we were all pretty much in the same boat. And none of us felt that we were being victimized or anything. We chose to do this, although we had the other options. Then we also had excellent people to work with. I mean, I worked for several years with Mehboobul Haq, who was probably the best economist Pakistan had produced. And Sartaj Aziz was my division chief for a while. And Moin Bakai, who was one of the best fiscal economists I have come across either in the World Bank or in Pakistan, was there. So it was an education to work with him. It was an education to work with Mehboob. The third thing was that since the Planning Commission was a relatively small body and had only recently been set up, we got opportunities. In fact, we had to take on responsibilities that in the normal course of events, we would not have got for many, many years later on. I mean, let me just give you one or two examples. When I was an assistant chief in the Planning Commission, which is the level I joined at, a couple of years after I joined it, Mehboob told me that you have to do the consortium document, I mean, the document on which our entire aid request for that year was based. You have to do it by yourself. He said, you and I will discuss the outline of the paper, you know, what the thrust of it should be, what the storyline should be. But after that, I only want to see the draft when it is has come out from the press. I want to, so this was a tremendous responsibility. I would have to write the paper. I would have to then take it to the press, have the draft printed over there, the security press, take it back to Mehboob, and he would just make a few changes in it and say, okay, now let me see the final version printed out, and that would go to all the donors, and that would be on which the document on which our foreign exchange budget for the year was based. May I imagine an assistant chief doing that. When I was a deputy chief, this is in 1971, and then being promoted to chief then also then. The deputy chairman, Kamarul Islam, called me in and he said, Khalid, Bangladesh has come into existence. It's split off from Pakistan. And there's this question of dividing the debt between Pakistan and Bangladesh. And he said that, you know, that the debt between India and Pakistan still hasn't been divided. And it's been a very acrimonious affair so far. But if we don't divide this debt between Pakistan and Bangladesh, then the donors will not give us any further aid because they hold us, Pakistan to be the successor state to the old Pakistan and hold us liable for all the debt that has been incurred by the United Country. And I want you to handle this separation of the debt. And I was stunned. I said, Kamar Sahib, I'm only a chief over here. There are many senior officers, and I know nothing about separating external debt. So he said, no, I've told the Prime Minister, that was Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. He said, I've told the Prime Minister that we can handle it. I'm giving you carte blanche. You can hire any consulting firm you like. I mean, on the legal side or on the economic side or on both. You can go to whichever country you want. You can go as often as you want. But you have to handle this and handle this pretty damn fast, because the country has been split. The main foreign exchange part, earning part of it has gone off. And we are in a pretty bad state. So I said to him that, you know, there's no point in my hiring consultants or anybody, because what instructions will I give them? I first have to learn the job myself. So he said, all right, you have carte blanche, you go do it. Now, I don't want to go into the long story of how we managed to do that, but he gave me this responsibility. I managed to discharge it without hiring a single consultant on the legal or the economic side. We got first a one-year separation of the debt, and then we got a permanent separation of the debt to everybody's satisfaction. I mean, Pakistan's and Bangladesh's.
So what I hear is that it was a very interesting time where not only did you have the best of Pakistan agglomerate in a certain space, that the best people got together in the planning commission, but they also were heard by the powers that be, whether it be you or the Prime Minister, whatever, they heard you and they were ready to give you responsibility and make you work.
Absolutely.
This has changed considerably over the years. Because when I was in the planning commission, for example, I didn't feel that at all. A, I couldn't hire good people, and B, I couldn't get the Prime Minister's or the President's ear. They were not ready to listen to the Planning Commission at all. So what has changed?
Well, you see, what has changed was that as I began by saying, that development was front and center of the government's program. And so the Planning Commission was in a very strong position, because it is the only organization in the entire government that mirrors the entire government. You have an agriculture ministry, you have an agriculture ministry, you have an agriculture section in the planning commission. You have an education ministry, you have an education section. And so you have all that information in one place, so it can be coordinated. You also then have the entire macroeconomic and fiscal and monetary and so on data and experts over there. So again, this is the one place where everything can come together. And I think that the earlier governments understood this. The second thing, Nadeem, which I think that which is what put you at a disadvantage when you were doing this, is that the Prime Minister, the President, and so on, all understood that their future depended on delivering the economic agenda. And so the Planning Commission was listened to, because it was the principal organization delivering the economic.
But Khalsa, wouldn't you say that Nawaz Sharif has understood that, and there is a big push for development with him, but he's still not looking to the Planning Commission?
I agree. I think partly it's a question of personalities, that I mean, in the government, whom he trusts and whom he counts on and whom he doesn't. But the second thing is, and let me be very blunt about this, that Nawaz Sharif and maybe every political government, but we don't know, they expect you to have a silver bullet that will deliver development without pain. Such a thing doesn't exist. Development is all about A, submitting yourself to the discipline of the plan, which means that a lot of ministries have to agree that they will not be the top priority, that they will be number two or number three and so on. And they don't like that. Now, the Ayub Khan government and even the Bhutto government to begin with, I mean, just forced the other ministries to submit to the discipline of the plan. The present government doesn't. You've got a series of different governorates, if you like. I mean, they, all of them screaming for resources. And as you yourself, I mean, you remember you commissioned that study on the throw forward. And we found that if you just to implement the projects, to finance the projects that were already approved, would take 11 and a half years. I mean, for 11 and a half years, you could have no new project if you were going to finish what you had already started. And since everybody, all the other ministries were screening to add more and more and more projects, the throw forward kept on increasing. You just had projects being stretched out indefinitely, paying interest on them, paying wages on them, paying all incurred costs of cost for them, and not getting any benefit.
So I think this is a very good point. What you're saying then is, and I think let's get into the subject of planning. When you did this planning commission work in the early 60s, what was the discipline and why was planning required? Because now, for example, in the 80s or 90s, or even now, there are a lot of people who would contend, and this happened, for example, even India has done this, that we need to get rid of the planning commission. So now the question arises, first of all, what was planning and should we continue to do that, or is there a different approach required?
Oh, I think that's a very good question. And I mean, it's an unanswered question, or more accurately, it's a question answered differently by different countries. But let's go back to why do you need a plan in the first place? The point is that if a country has a certain goal, then, especially on the economic side, let's say it's got an economic goal, you've got in Pakistan 180 million people. Let's say that the average family size is 6. You've got 30 million independent decision makers. How are you going to get these 30 million independent decision makers to make decisions that further the economic goal of the country? Now, secondly, if you leave it to the Adam Smith's invisible hand, I mean, apart from all the externalities and other problems that arise, it's going to take much more time. So if you've got to achieve your economic goals within a limited amount of time, you've got to find some way to get these 30 million independent decision makers working in a certain direction. The different political systems have tried to solve these this in different ways. I mean, for example, the Soviets reduced the decision makers to one. I mean, the government would decide everything. It would say, you will get these resources and you will produce such and such a thing. And we all know all the problems that that led to. But essentially what they were trying to do was to compress the 30 million decision makers into one decision maker. So that, that, and that would push in the direction of the plan. The democracies, especially after the Second World War, when planning became very much in vogue, handled this in a different manner. I mean, for example, take France, which was one of the most successful implementers of planning in a mixed economy. What they did essentially was to try to create oligopolies. They provided incentives for firms to merge together and disincentives for them to remain separate. And the incentives that they offered were quite often were fiscal incentives. That if you were an oligopoly in a key sector, I mean in car manufacture or construction or something, you got tax breaks that other people didn't get. And this encouraged firms to merge and to become oligopolies. In fact, I remember a discussion I had with a French planner. He came to the meeting that day rubbing his hands and saying, oh, he had created a veritable holocaust of firms. I mean, he had massacred a number of firms into joining together and becoming oligopolies. So they reduced the number of decision makers by making oligopolies. The Dutch, who were also very successful at planning in a mixed economy, they did a similar thing by giving price advantages. I mean, they had price controls after the Second World War. But if a major firm did aligned its policies in line with the government's priorities, they were allowed to raise prices. They also had the good fortune in that if you took their major firms, I mean, which were Unilever, Royal Dutch Shell, the KLM, the airline, the trade unions, and the railways, you accounted for about 50% of the GNP of the country. So if you managed to control these firms or provided the right incentives and disincentives for these firms, you got 50% of the policymakers, decision makers, acting in line with the government's priorities. So as I say, I mean, the planning with them has all been the attempt to reduce the number of...
Didn't we try this in Pakistan with the textiles and the automobiles and the fertilizers, and we've ended up with rent seekers who are really not taking off? So in a sense, what gives? Why was France successful, and why do we have a situation where we've got oligopolies, but those oligopolies are not exporting? Those oligopolies are still sitting on SROs. They still consume SROs more than productivity. They're still not capable of tackling the world market.
Nadeem, again, I mean, you know, you put your finger on the key problem. Once you create these oligopolies, what prevents them from being rent seeking? Well, a very good example to look at is the Korean War. Because in 1962, Korea was a poorer country than Pakistan. In fact, they had sent a delegation from the planning ministry to look at the Pakistan Planning Commission and the and PIDE, the Pakistan Institute of Development Economics, to see how they worked together and how they worked. And I'm not saying that the Koreans made their plans on the basis of Pakistan's plans, but certainly Pakistan's planning and its institutions provided a useful input into them. What the Koreans did was that they already had a system of oligopolies, if you like, in place. Remember that Korea from 1910 to 1945 had been ruled by the Japanese. And the Japanese system of industrialization relied on the zaibatsu, which is that they had a holding company. Let's say you're looking at Mitsubishi. You had a Mitsubishi Shipping Corporation, a Mitsubishi Shipbuilding Corporation, a Mitsubishi Marine Engineering Corporation, a Mitsubishi Car Building Corporation, a Mitsubishi Food Making Corporation, a Mitsubishi Chemical Corporation, and so on and so on. And the majority of the shares in all of these were held by a holding company, which would be, let's say, just call it Mitsubishi Holding. You similarly had this with others. I mean, the four biggest were Mitsubishi, Mitsui, Sumitomo, Yasuda, and so on. Now, these were broken up after the Second World War. They were broken up by McNamara. But they've come together in informal groupings where the presidents of these companies have a monthly lunch together. The Koreans basically followed this system. So you have a Hyundai holding company, and that had the majority of shares in Hyundai shipbuilding, Hyundai car making, Hyundai heavy engineering, Hyundai textiles, Hyundai chemicals, Hyundai this and Hyundai that, and similarly with Daewoo, and similarly with Samsung, and similarly with the others. Samsung, in fact, I mean, now is the biggest chaebol, as they are called in Korea. It has 70 member companies that the holding company controls. Now, why do they not go in for rent seeking? I mean, they would love to go in for rent seeking, but the man who started the Korean development was President Park. When he seized power in 1961, he followed the old system. He had crony capitalists, he had rent seekers, he had everything. But then he fortunately also had a series of economic advisors who gave him the following argument. Nadeem, they said to him, and I've spoken to some of them, they said to him that, General Park, your primary responsibility is to the security of Korea. And these days, security rests on a strong economy. You can't have a modern army or a modern air force without having a modern economy. Now, at the moment, we've got the Americans helping us, but you can't rely on them because President Carter has already started pulling out American troops from Korea. So we have to stand on our own feet and build our own economy. Now, to build our own economy, we need, for investment, we need the resources, but we don't have the resources. So we have to borrow the resources. So if we borrow the resources from abroad, we have to repay them in foreign exchange. And the only way we can earn foreign exchange is through exports. So they closed the circle saying that, therefore, if you want to ensure Korea's security, you have to export. You have to export or die. I mean, basically, that's it. Now, President Park took this advice to heart. And he then organized monthly meetings of Korean chaebols, which the president personally chaired. Every month he would chair the meeting. And he would ask each one of them, what have you done by way of exports? And have you met your target? And if you haven't met your target, why haven't you met your target? Is it because you didn't have access to foreign exchange for imports? Is it because you couldn't hire the right skills? Is it because the port capacity was small? Is it because the railways didn't deliver? Or is it because the tax inspector was bothering you? Whatever, whatever, whatever. And he would give instructions at these monthly meetings to fix the problem. And then, you know, a few months later, again, he would ask you that now the problem was fixed. What is your excuse now for not exporting? So you had these incentives, but then you also had the stick. Because if you didn't export, then he would force you to sell a part of your conglomerate, a part of your chaebol, to a successful exporter. Now, I asked them, because I mean, I spent 10 years working on Korea, and I asked them, very frankly, what is there in the Korean system, in the Korean legal system, for example, that enables the president to force a chaebol to sell part of its empire? And the answer that I got from the president of Daewoo and the president of Samsung was that there's nothing really in the law that permits him to do this, but the economic structure is such that permits him to do this, that enables him to do this. And he said it works as follows. We each have a prime bank from which we can borrow. I mean, you can only borrow from the National Bank of Pakistan. You can't go to the Habib Bank and borrow from them, say, for example. And the prime bank, if we are not exporting, the prime bank is told not to extend any further credit to this chaebol. So we can't meet the utility bill, we can't meet the wage bill, we can't meet the tax bill, we are technically bankrupt, we can go to jail. So we then have to put up one of our firms for sale, and the only person allowed to bid for it is a successful exporter. And since there's only one purchaser, he can pay whatever he wants.
But that is a benevolent dictator model. Yeah. And the problem with Pakistan is that we haven't got a benevolent dictator. We end up with all kinds of politicians who put their own interest to the fore. We've seen that. And I don't think they're going to work this model. But let's step back a little. Can you please tell our audience, I hope is a bunch of students who are interested in learning economics, etc., how would you describe to them the process of planning and what is the appropriate way to do planning? First of all, what was it in the 60s? How has it evolved and how should economies be planned now, if at all they should be planned?
Well, okay. I do believe that there's a role for planning, but there's a different role from planning now compared to the 1960s. In the 1960s, you see, you first did have a benevolent dictator on the economic side. I mean, Ayub Khan, pretty much a benevolent dictator on the economic side, whatever else he was on the political side, it didn't matter. But what we had was certain instruments for planning. For example, there was the industrial investment schedule, which said that West Pakistan can only have so many spindles and so many looms, I mean, for example, in the textile industry, and so many will be in the Punjab, and so many will be in Sindh, and so many will be in the frontier, and so many will be in, you know, whatever else, in Balochistan or whatever. Ditto for the other things. Now, it doesn't mean that these were hard and fast. I mean, these guidelines were maintained for the main part, although they were breached in various parts. I mean, sometimes you exceeded them and sometimes you fell short of them. But you had these tools which you no longer have. Because, as I wrote in my paper, that the things that have changed from that time are three. A, globalization. B, privatization. And C, decentralization to the provinces. I mean, these have reduced the space of planning by fiat. the planning commission or the Ministry of Finance or the Prime Minister can't sit down and say, you will do X. X will be done.
But Bishop, before we go there, please describe to us what did you do? How did you make up a plan in those days? And what role did the plan play in the economy?
Well, the plan was made up. I mean, first, there was a lot of consultation with the provinces.
Mm-hmm.
Then at one point, West Pakistan was turned into a single province. Because, I mean, you know, there was East Pakistan was one province, and so they said to balance it, West Pakistan should be one province. And there was a lot of interaction with the planning agencies and the development agencies, first in the four separate provinces, which later on became one province with that. And then there was a lot of interaction with the private sector also. But the private sector, as you can understand, was a lot of it was rent seeking. And so you always had the struggle with them of trying to make them say that you would try to get your money through efficiency rather than through exchange arbitrage or you know, tax concessions or something. And I won't pretend that we always won that battle. But then you had, so you first had a perspective plan, which actually was not a plan so much as perspective framework, a long-term framework, a 20-year framework, and for which the goals were rather broad. For example, narrowing the gap between the per capita incomes of East and West Pakistan. Or you had another long-term goals about how much electricity would be required, how much water would be required, what sort of education would be required to produce a technically oriented labor force. But these could not be hard and fast targets for each year. These could just be that if you want to go in this direction, X, Y, and Z is what you had to do. So within the framework of this perspective plan, then you made five-year plans which were a little more specific, where the goals would be narrow the difference between per capita incomes of East and West Pakistan by X percent over these 5 years. And this would require so much investment in the public sector, so much in the private sector, and so forth. And then the really operational document would be the annual plan, which was linked with the budget. And but the thing was that the annual plan, strictly, and the five-year plan to a considerable extent, imposed a discipline on all the ministries. I mean, there were frank discussions, I think, but basically, the Planning Commission was listened to because A, it produced quality work, and B, the powers that be recognized that you had to have a coordinated effort at development. You couldn't have 15 different ministries charging off in 15 different directions, each one of them trying to get as much money as it could for its own pet projects. These pet projects had to fit into some general overall goal and scheme, otherwise they wouldn't be financed.
Hello?
I'm here. Let's okay. That.
Go ahead. Then tell me. So, the planning process at that stage was that basically you had controls in the economy that you could use, levers in the economy that you could use.
Yeah.
But more importantly, you had objectives that were agreed to by everybody, all the departments, including everybody, including the provinces, including the localities, whatever.
Yeah.
And that you were able to integrate the plan with the budget and all the money flows that were coming in, and that you were able to use the money flows to your advantage, to the objectives that you wanted to go to. But most importantly, as you said earlier, there was a certain discipline in the economy. That even the dictator, the benevolent dictator, ensured that there was a certain discipline in the economy, everybody followed the system. Now, given what you said later, that with globalization and privatization and decentralization, etc., the world economy has moved on. So should we just fold up the Planning Commission? Do we need a Planning Commission? Do we need planning anymore? Or do we just need the finance ministry to do the budgets?
You see, as economies have developed, I mean, for example, take Korea, where planning was the most powerful thing. From the 60s to almost 2000. The Minister of Planning was, you see, let me step back a minute, that if you're going to coordinate the work of different ministries, then whichever ministry is going to do the coordination has to have some kind of authority over them, over the others. And that authority is provided in different ways. I mean, for example, the Koreans had a deputy prime minister in charge of the economy. And when I worked on Korea, they had 23 ministries in the cabinet. 12 of them came under the deputy prime minister for the economy. And the other 11 also really didn't come under the prime minister because security, I mean, internal security, foreign affairs, and defense were handled by the president. So, and the ground rules were that these 12 economic ministries, I mean, you know, trade and agriculture and industry and, you know, finance and so on, they met separately. They decided on a policy separately. And then they took it to the main cabinet, essentially to be rubber stamped. A fresh discussion was not opened up. So that was the extent of the power that the Deputy Prime Minister for Economic Affairs had. And the Deputy Prime Minister for Economic Affairs was generally an outstanding economist. I mean, and so were the other ministers. I mean, every minister, every Deputy Prime Minister that I worked with in Korea, and I worked with about four of them, had a PhD from a major American university. Every finance minister had a PhD from a major American university. And the second thing was that the Korean Development Institute provided the research for the Ministry of Planning. What I should have also said is the Minister of Planning was the Deputy Prime Minister for in charge of the economy. So there was a formal way in which this man outranked the others and could secure their coordination. Other countries handle it differently. I mean, for example, in Malaysia, when I was responsible for the World Bank's economic work over there, the economic planning unit was placed in the Prime Minister's office. So the head of the economic planning unit would speak with the authority of the Prime Minister. So that's way, that was the way he was considered higher than many of the other ministers or could secure their coordination.
Because, but speak to this.
Yeah.
Do we need a planning commission? And what Modi has done has disbanded the planning commission.
Modi has said he dismantled the planning commission, but I mean that you are underestimating the power of the Indian bureaucrat. I mean, if you think the planning commission will disappear, it's changed its name and changed some of its functions, but it's still there. I mean, and different thing. And I agree that the planning commission's functions should and method should change. Because for one thing, so long as you've got a large public sector investment program, that will be handled by the planning commission anyway. Or some planning body, call it whatever you want. I mean, that. But secondly, that since the planning commission mirrors the entire economy, mirrors the entire government, and has information on the entire economy, its role should be much more of what the French and the Dutch and the others then developed into, which is indicative planning. That by providing information about the government's intentions in the economy and providing, getting a feedback from the private sector about what their plans were, and saying that, you know, such a thing is not going to be feasible. I mean, for example, the private sector wants to set up an aluminium firm factory. Okay, fine, you want to set up an aluminium factory, but you're not going to have enough electricity for it. There are no plans for generating that kind of electricity. So maybe you should either scale down the scale of your project or defer it. I mean, you know, so ditto. I mean, if you're planning a car factory, but some of these parts that you expected to procure locally are not going to be available because the engineering companies have no plans for doing that. So either you guys get together and, I mean, sort this out and get these made, or the engineering companies will say that the scale of production required to produce these parts is much greater than we have, than we can afford. So you either have to, the car company has to either change its plans or to rely on imports for these parts. So it's more of a coordinating role.
But Haladiko, there's another problem that I would like to raise.
Yeah.
The planning process really was based on a public sector investment program. and it was the public sector investment program was built into the budget, and the donor program, so it coordinated the donors and the budget into a public investment program.
Yeah.
And to that extent, it was very successful. But two things happened, I think, which are very important to bear in mind.
Yeah.
One is that mega projects came along, big projects. And those big projects was very hard for the Planning Commission to control. They kind of went out of control on their own. And, Tarbela or Mangla became so big that they were an entity unto themselves, and the Planning Commission couldn't really control them apart from just giving them money. So the mega projects are a problem. The second important thing also happened is the donors also became more intrusive. For example, when you were making the second or the first five-year plan, the donors were really not doing anything more than supporting you. But now the donors have their own, plans, what they call these country assistant programs or whatever. They have those plans too. And those plans have a life of their own. And they are not very well coordinated with the Planning Commission. The donors are multiplied there. Now, instead of having you had to deal with maybe two donors, USAID and the World Bank. Now, when I was there, there were about 30 or 40 donors, and they all had their independent plans, their independent constituencies in their own ministries. But one very important donor, the IMF, for example, comes in with a program, which is a three-year program, which places restrictions on everything, and it actually uses the public sector development program as a residual. So that the public sector development program more or less adjusts to the fund program every year or second year. How do you plan in that environment?
The point that you raised is crucial, because Pakistan's savings fall quite short of the miserable investment rate that Pakistan has. The savings are even short of that. So we keep turning to donors, and we keep giving them this lever to, impose their own agendas, if you like. But the point really, again, comes back to the quality of work that the Planning Commission does with donors, and the amount of backing, the political backing, that it gets from the political leadership. I mean, the donors, when we were working on things, the donors also had their pet projects. But the point is that we were in a position to tell the donors that we don't want this. I mean, let me give you a number of examples. For example, I really don't want to name countries, that were involved. But you would find that they either wanted to support a sector that was not a priority sector, or they wanted, or the terms of their lending were terms that we didn't like. So these guys would come along to the consortium meetings, and year after year, they would pledge 50 million, 20 million, 6 million, 35 million, whatever it was. And the Planning Commission never let this be used. Because when a ministry came along and said, we want, 5 million from this Belgian loan, for example, we would say, well, that's all very nice. I mean, the 5 million is there in the Belgian loan, but the terms are not one that we can afford, because we've got guidelines for the loans, that it has to have a grant element of at least, 40% or 60% or whatever it was that year. And the combination of interest rate, grace period, doesn't... and the maturity doesn't give us a grant element of that. And we had the political backing to say, no, we have to refuse that loan. Simply the availability of money doesn't mean that that money will be used. I'm not sure that the Planning Commission can do that now. And that's why you get these agendas imposed. I mean, if we had this... when I was there, we had this, we want to provide such and such money to this democracy publicizing unit. I mean, probably had a better name, but for that. And we said, well, I'm sorry, but we are not prepared to take a loan for this. And then we said, okay, supposedly make it a grant.
There is a problem there. You see, the point is, when you have a fund program, the need for filling the financing gap is imperative.
Yeah.
And what happens is that the finance ministry and the fund want to fill that financing gap. So whatever the Planning Commission might say, they will succumb to the marginal donor's needs, because the financing plan has to be fulfilled. Now, in this day and age, I don't see how the Planning Commission can contest with that, unless you have a very cerebral and intelligent government at the top, which we don't have. as you said, Korea had PhDs, etc.
Yeah.
We have, you know, you will see our leaders. I mean, what do we do?
See, basically what our leaders want is the silver bullet. That, I mean, for example, why do we have this financing gap all the time? Is everybody paying the tax that they should? I mean, this is a purely rhetorical question. They are not. I mean, why are exports going in for a secular decline? Why is Pakistan being deindustrialized? I mean, this is, does anybody give a damn about these things? You see, let me come back to this question about coordination and the lack of it in the government. You have the Planning Commission now, yesterday, today, and even tomorrow, saying that what we are doing is an export-oriented development strategy. I mean, it's coming out of our ears, I mean, that the amount of times this phrase has been repeated. And at the same time, you have the finance ministry taking great pride in maintaining the nominal exchange rate at some arbitrary level, when our inflation rate is higher than that of our competitors. The finance ministry does not understand that the effective exchange rate is what an importer responds to, what the buying country will respond to. And the effective exchange rate has been appreciating. And so the finance ministry is going in one direction. The planning ministry is saying that its plans are going in another direction. And nobody at the top, the prime minister or whoever, you knock heads together and say either get your words together or get your policies together.
Now, Khalid, another direction that I want to take you in.
Yes.
I think since the early days of the Planning Commission and since the Planning Commission was formed, and the world was planning, the world, as you said, has changed a lot. As you said, globalization, all these factors. But I think the world has changed in another very important sense, which is development thinking. Development thinking in the early days was based on the two-gap model, was based on the Ghashankran backwardness model, was based on the fact that somehow we needed to push for infrastructure and industrialization. But now, I think you'll agree with me, I mean, the book to quote here that everybody quotes and I think become very popular is Why Nations Fail, that in order to get growth going, what is important is now institutional development, institutional reform, and getting the economy prepared to meet the challenges of the 21st century, which are technology, globalization, and getting efficiency to the core. How can the Planning Commission do that, or can it do it?
No. The Planning Commission cannot do that. I mean, nor should one expect the Planning Commission to be able to do that, because when one talks about institutions, and Nadeem, remember, that the document that you presented to the National Economic Council and which was approved by the National Economic Council was very strong on institutional development and on governance and on these matters. And so the Planning Commission was helpful in drafting that document, but implementing it required a much stronger body and a much wider body and much wider push to do it. Because when you talk about institutions, you're talking about deeply held beliefs or behaviors that have persisted for a very long time. You can't expect that to be changed by one organization in the space of 5 years. I mean, let's take a few examples. I mean, first of all, you are pushing in absolutely the right direction. You can't have sustainable long-term growth without institutional reform. But you can't expect institutional reform to take place overnight. So, and remember, the argument that we made in that thing was that even if you believe that the hardware of growth is important, what the paper that you presented was arguing that you need institutional improvements to decrease the cost of doing business, which would increase the profitability and would therefore give incentives to put in more hardware and to use that efficiently. It wasn't an either-or question, but it was a question that without the governance and the institutional improvements, the hardware would be useless. That and many people didn't seem to understand that link. Because after that document, I've argued this with dozens of people in Pakistan, I mean, and elsewhere, that what their document was saying, not that there's a conflict between a hardware approach and a software approach, but that without the software, the hardware is not going to be anything. That's exactly. Why, look at the...
in fact, I'd go further. I'd say that it's the software that will catalyze the hardware.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, it would increase the efficiency of the hardware, make it more productive and more profitable, and therefore give you the incentive to make more hardware. I think if that link had been understood, people would have understood the importance of their document.
Khalid, there's a problem. I mean, let me step back. The need, as far as I can see from development economics, the need now is for institutional development. I think for too long, the price that has been paid by the countries that have lagged behind, East Asia did it. You were there. You saw East Asia do it. But as you've seen Egypt, much closer than me, but I've seen some of Egypt too. Egypt also doesn't have the capability of developing the modern institutions that are required. Much of Africa is struggling with the same problem. We in Pakistan, and I would even put India there, India is also struggling with the problem. They are getting brute force growth going, the same thing that happened in the early days of East Asia. But then you have to brute force growth. By what do I mean by that? I mean factor accumulation, pumping in investment, etc. But productivity increases really come when you have institutional development. Sure. Now, the problem, policy problem that I see and that needs to be confronted is, how do we, in a country like Pakistan or even in Egypt or even in Africa, how do we get institutional development going? And I think something must be done through policy for getting institutional development. What is your view on that?
My view is that it's not just my view. I mean, if you look at all the cross-country regressions on growth also, the only factor that comes out as statistically significant in all these is that institutions matter, is institutional development. Otherwise, I mean, now Bob Dylan has won the Nobel Prize for Literature. There's a song of his which says, "The answer, my friend, is floating in the wind." You know, you take one country and you get one statistically significant factor. You take another one, you get another one, and so on and so on and so on. The only consistent thing between countries is the importance of institutions. But let's break this down into what do you mean by institutions and what are you going to do about them. Now, let's take Egypt as an example. That if you look at four or five of the biggest institutional blocks to Egyptian development, they would be the commercial judicial system, the bureaucracy, the tax system, and the system of education and technical training. I mean, maybe you can add more to the list, but we identified these four as the most important. Now, if you look at the commercial judicial system, what do you find? You find that the average case took 7 years to resolve and then a further 4 years to implement. And the average cost, the court costs, was 7.5% of the final settlement. And they were so high because the commercial judicial system was being used to subsidize the criminal legal system. But basically, I mean, you know, that it would be on average 11 or 12 years before you got your due, assuming everything was done in time. I mean, you know, all the documents were filed on time. And because it lasted for the average cost lasted for 11 years, I mean, the lawyers gave me tons of examples of cases lasting 20 years also. But if the average lasts 11 years, just think of what the lawyer's fees would add up to. So they haven't tackled that because too many vested interests would be hurt. You know, too many people are making a good living out of that. Look at the bureaucracy. When I worked on Egypt, 1/3 of the entire labor force was employed by the government, and this did not include the public enterprises or the armed forces. Add another 3 million to that. I mean, you would have something like 40% of the labor force working. Now, that's been reduced progressively with the public sector enterprises being phased out. They've come down from 900,000 employed to 400,000 employed. But still, you've got between 25 and 30% of the labor force employed by the government. Where are these guys going to go if you sack?
But don't you think that the challenge going forward is really to tackle this problem? We have to tackle the problem. I mean, what you're saying is true of Pakistan as well, and many of these countries. That, for God's sakes, as you said, judicial, you know, resolving contractual disputes takes a long time. Even that means that you can't write contracts properly. If you can't write contracts properly, then nobody's willing to invest. And therefore, the whole cycle sort of goes back. If you have a large, bloated public sector, it imposes a huge cost, not only on the government, but also on everybody else, because that bloated public sector is doing all kinds of crazy things. So, I mean, this is the key challenge. And somehow, I think we economists have to contend with it. Have we solved this problem or have we not?
You know, you see, it just depends what you mean by solve this problem. Economists do often say all that you need to do is to wind up the is to privatize the public enterprises. But that's where you start running into political economy problems. Because what you have is, let's again take Egypt as an example, because I saw the privatization effort over there from scratch. You basically said, okay, the trade unions can be quite strong. Labor will be demonstrating in the streets and burning government buses and stoning government buildings and so on. So what we will do is phase down the public sector by attrition. Somebody retires, you don't replace him. Or we will offer them golden handshakes. And the golden handshake took the form of we'll give them a lump sum of 3 years' wages. And then they can go off and, you know, do whatever they want. I mean, they can start a farm of their own. They can invest this and live off the money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It worked all right for the first 2 or 3 or 4 years. And then they ran into a problem. They ran into the problem because the wages were so low that the three-year lumps sum payment was okay for the government. In fact, the IMF figured that if you wanted to reduce the labor force from 900,000 to 300,000, you only needed to pay for one time 2.5% of your GDP. And you didn't have to pay that from the government resources because the donors were prepared to give something like between 1% and 1.5% of GDP. So, you, in a way, you could solve that problem. But what happened was that the flip side of the coin was that because it was so cheap for the government to do this, it also meant that the worker who took this golden handshake in the face of inflation soon didn't have a cushion to fall back on. And since the economy wasn't expanding, where would he find another job? So you started having in Mahalla al-Kubra and, you know, Kafrat Dawar and all the big textile mills, you had huge demonstrations. And basically, this is what the minister in charge of privatization told me. He said that the headache became more than the economic benefit. The political headache became more than the economic. So they just decided to freeze that. And if they froze the program, I mean, by saying that, okay, we'll have a different way, we'll issue vouchers to every Egyptian and he'll have a share in the profits of this company and so on, but Parliament has to rule on that. Knowing, of course, that Parliament would never rule on that, which it never did. And so effectively from 2010, the privatization program was frozen. So, I mean, in a sense, the economists didn't solve it, but the politician didn't solve it.
But Khalid, there's another problem that's crept up, I think, which is also important. Think about it, that in the days when you were planning or Korea was planning, the world was much simpler. Globalization is one thing, but there's another thing also which is very important, which has created a big problem. The fact that technological improvements have happened, and technological improvements have a certain demand in the economy, in particular, the fact that now we need to regulate many more markets. For example, the energy market was not there. Even the stock market was in a very nascent. And various other markets that didn't exist then, which now exist. So there's a whole regulatory burden of the government that also has to be taken into account. And we in most of these countries, for example, environment issues were not there. What we've started doing in developing countries is merely copying the West, and even the World Bank comes and advises us to copy the West. Just build the same institutions as the West. So everybody has a mortgage for refinance corporation, everybody has an environmental protection agency, everybody has this or that. But that places a certain demand on the government and bloats the government too.
Yeah, but Nadeem, it's actually worse than that you're portraying it. Because the point is that what you have and what you have in the Planning Commission, I mean, I spent 2014 working five visits to the Planning Commission, worked there for several months. And frankly, I was horrified. I was horrified. The stuff that I used to do as an assistant chief, you can't get done at the level of chiefs. I mean, but so what I'm trying to point out is this, that you've got these new markets, I mean, new financial instruments that have to be regulated, derivatives and so on. You've got the energy market that has to be regulated. You've got the environment problems and so on. So the World Bank comes along, let's say for the sake of example, and says that you should ape the West and have a ministry or have a corporation or have an institution, let's say, that regulates these things. So you set this up. But where the hell do you get the qualified people to man these? You are going to pay government salaries to people who have these niche skills, who could make 10 times that much in the private sector. What you've got is the shell of the institution, you've got the post of the institution, and you've got people who are...
Let me ask you, doesn't the problem lie in where we began when you said that you were paid $600 and it was only your motivation and your... missionary spirit that made you work that.
600 rupees.
600 rupees a month, sorry. And that, sorry, not dollars, 100 rupees a month. But then in 1975, when reality bit you and maybe you had a growing family or whatever, you went to the World Bank. Now, please tell us, why did you go to the World Bank?
Oh, very simple. My story is I was kicked out of the Planning Commission.
That's very interesting. Tell us how.
This is my version of it. I mean, what happened was that there was a series of family crises. My brother had died. My father-in-law had died. My father had died. So I wanted to get out of the system for a few years. And I was... the World Bank offered me a permanent job and I refused it. And then they offered me a 3-year assignment, fixed term. So with the Planning Commission's permission, I took that. 3 weeks. 3 weeks before I was due to go to it, I was called in and told that the Planning Commission had changed its mind and it would not give me the 3 years deep, that I could either resign and go or stay. So I said, well, the World Bank had offered me this job in July 1974, and I had said I couldn't come before the end of February 1975 because I wanted to finish the stuff I was doing in the Planning Commission. And so they had put off the biggest mission, I mean, which I led later on, it was an 18-person mission to Egypt. They had put off major pieces of work from July 1974 to March 1975, just so that I could come and lead that mission. I couldn't tell them in the middle of February that, okay, cheer up, boys, I'm not coming. That's just not on. I mean, it's very unprofessional. So I said I would resign. So,
but tell me, it's not just that you left. I mean, what intrigues me always, and maybe we should put this on record, that that was the time that the Planning Commission lost almost all its human capital. Mahbubul Haq left at about the same time. Sartarji left at the same time. So many people, Parvez Hassan left at the same time. I mean, I can think, I don't know, you may be able to think up of more people, but I think many people left at the same time. So what happened that all of these people, Planning Commission more or less lost its skill base at one point in time?
That's very true. What happened actually at that time was that you got a very politically oriented government, which... frankly, didn't understand anything about economic. The fourth plan we made, and we'd gone through the usual hoops. I mean, the introduction to the plan, the outline of the plan, the main targets, and so on. And we'd reached the draft plan stage. And there was a meeting chaired by Mr. Bhutto, the entire cabinet sitting over there, and so on. And one of the ministers put up his hand and said, that I think we should reject this plan. Mr. Bhutto asked why. And he said, because you see, the election is coming up and this bank will be seen as being the economic plank of your manifesto. And if you reveal your hand, you will be outbid. So Mr. Bhutto said, what do you mean? So this man said, well, look, it says that we would aim at a minimum wage of 300 rupees a month. Well, the opposition will say, we'll come, if we come to power, we'll have 500 rupees a month. So if we say we will do X, the opposition will say we'll do X plus Y. I mean, you know, so simply on this 10-minute, 15-minute exchange, Mr. Bhutto said, okay, I'm not clearing this plan to go forward. You have to, if we need a document for the donors, fine, make it a document for the donors. But you will remove the references to the fourth plan. You will call it the development perspective. So the wretched document came out with this absurd remark that the development perspective will generate 1,400 jobs or whatever it was. The development perspective will boost exports to whatever number it was, etc., etc. And I think that was a crucial turning point, because people then felt that if a socialist government is going to treat planning and economic development in this way, then we are wasting our time in this organization. That's what triggered that's the trigger for a major part of the exodus from there.
How much of it was the fact that your welfare was being devalued all the time, because your salary is obviously not keeping up with international?
No, our salaries weren't keeping up. I mean, my salary at that time, I can tell you what it was. It was 750 rupees or 780 rupees at the time. So, I mean, this is after 13 years in the planning.
And the World Bank was offering you probably thousands of dollars.
Yes, and so, and which I had incidentally refused twice.
But the fact that all of you left at the same time signals to me that perhaps the economic incentive might have been important. And the second incentive that might have been important is also that, were you totally comfortable with the civil service system, or were you kind of feeling like, I noticed when I was in the planning commission that most of the technical staff was very frustrated by the fact that their career profile was locked in at grade 20. None of them could become the secretary planning. And there was only one chief economist position available. But otherwise, the rest of the staff would only get to the chief, and they had no further.
Nadeem, that's true. But I mean, the point is that there was a glass ceiling over there. But I mean, I hadn't hit it yet. So that wasn't the factor with me. And secondly, the fact that so many people left at about the same time doesn't say that much about the economic incentives being offered elsewhere. Because I mean, the economic incentives had been on offer for some time. So there should have been a steady drip, 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 drip of people leaving. It was more that the political backing had disappeared. And that then you felt that, why are we making this economic sacrifice when nobody's, when the professional work has been devalued? So it was that that tilted the seesaw in favor of the economic incentive, if you like.
Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with this situation that has crept up now? That if we prepare a plan in the planning commission, each donor, starting off the World Bank, the ADB, USAID, DFID, the German aid, the French aid, you know, all these donors have their own documents for forward planning. They call them country strategy papers, they call them, you know, whatever. But these plans exist, and none of them have been coordinated with the planning commission. How do you function?
No. See, it varies. I don't know how the Germans and the Dutch and so on do it. But I mean, the World Bank is supposed to do it. And certainly in Egypt, I did it in conjunction with the government. I mean, let me describe what I did for the country strategy paper, as it was called in those days. I don't know what it's called now. Now it's called the country assistance strategy something. Anyway, what I did was that on our own analysis and working with the Ministry of Planning in Egypt, we made an outline of what we thought were the main bottlenecks to Egyptian development and what could be done, I mean, what should be done and what the World Bank could help do. Then this was circulated, I mean, this was fleshed out, and that paper was circulated to 17 ministries in the Egyptian government. 14 of them replied. Now, 5 of them said they had no comments, so effectively 9 replied. And these 9 replied with, I mean, you know, that we would like a different emphasis for our sector in this, and we would like this and so on. But then we had 2 or 3 sessions with each of these ministries. Then the paper that emerged from all this was then sent to the NGOs. Now, at that time, there were, under the Ministry of Social Welfare, there were 14,263, I think, NGOs. So obviously, it couldn't go to all of them.
But there's another problem that comes up, even if we do all that.
Yeah.
The donors have a quantitative lending commitment every year that they have to meet at home. They are there to lend money. They are there to make sure that those monetary targets are met.
No, no, Deem, I mean, that's not true. I mean, that it may be true for some governments, but I mean, for example, when I was in the Planning Commission, the Belgian aid never got used. Never. The Italian aid never got fully used. I mean, the terms were unacceptable to us. And so the Ministry of the EAD was told not to negotiate the...
But my point is that if these donors, for example, now the big donors, that's a long time ago, but the big donors now, USAID, DFID, World Bank, etc., they have their annual targets. They have to report back to their headquarters, parliaments, etc., to make these annual targets work. And they have a lending imperative. But at the same time, we have an institutional, let's say if we worked economics properly, we have an institutional development paradigm. As you said, institutional development takes a long time, right? But it has a different time scale. Now, if we are trying to do institutional development at the same time meet lending targets, that's a huge contradiction there. How do we deal with that?
No, you see, the contradiction can be resolved and resolved in a straightforward manner by us being clear about our priorities. I mean, about 5 or 6 years ago, I was sent along with the World Bank mission. I mean, I was just a consultant, but I was asked to go along over there. The World Bank had a $25 million loan essentially for institutional development. It was for training of the civil service and so on, you know, seeing best practice in other countries, etc., etc. And Pakistan used, over the period that this loan was supposed to be disbursed, less than half. And when I asked the Pakistanis, why are you wasting this money? Because this is, you know, pretty much a grant, and it's for institutional development, and, you know, it's whatever it is. I mean, the non-grant part of it is repayable over 16 years. I mean, why aren't you taking it? And it was not interested.
Okay.
I don't believe that the bureaucracy in Pakistan is interested in training itself and becoming better. I mean, in stark contrast to Korea, let me tell you that in Korea, I've seen undersecretaries, which correspond to our secretary of the ministry, two economic ministers, one of them became Minister of Finance and then Foreign Affairs, Kang Bong-yoon, and the other one, Jin Yong, who became Deputy Prime Minister also, Minister of Energy. They did their PhDs while in office as minister. They would work in the evenings. I mean, learning and self-improvement is not ingrained in the Pakistani psyche. I'm sorry to tell you this.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point.
But whenever I raise this, I mean, let me tell you from the Planning Commission, which is supposed to be this. When I joined the Planning Commission and we were working on the second five-year plan, at that time, this Deontief's input-output analysis was in vogue, and we needed to construct an input-output table for Pakistan to see, I mean, you know, where the biggest interlinks were and what the foreign exchange requirements of the subsectors were and so on. We knew damn all about it. So, from the Harvard group, we got hold of Alfred Conrad, who was a professor at Harvard and one of Deontief's star pupils. He came over in the summer and spent 3 months with us working on, you know, teaching input-output analysis. And he brought the literature and he did this and this and that. So, Javed Asfar and I said that let us have him give us lectures on input-output analysis. And we in the Planning Commission, at least the part of the Planning Commission that were going to be dealing with this, we should attend these lectures after office hours and get trained in this technique, which we'll have to use for the plan. I thought, this is a fantastic opportunity. You're getting a top-class man to virtually, I mean, teach 6 or 8 people. It's like a private tuition. I mean, you know, teach them input-output analysis and its uses and its shortcomings and how to get around those shortcomings and so on and so on and so on. Imagine my horror. Not one person of the group that should have been in this wanted to join. And when I asked them, why not? You know the answer that I got? Answer number one was, gee, where is it in our contract that we have to go to school? Answer number two, oh, if we don't understand something, this could go down on our annual report and our promotion or our increment might be held up because they'll say that you are too stupid to understand what was being taught. Complete collapse of class, only about 3 or 4% then all foreign educated went to
these sad things. Sad to say, Khaled Sahib, it's still the same. When you were there, you had the good, you know, you involved the planning commission, I should mention, even after your World Bank career, you worked on the framework of economic growth, you worked on the Vision 2025, so you also did a paper on the reform of the planning commission, so you've been involved in the planning commission throughout, it's your love of life. Unfortunately, things have deteriorated so much now that when we arrange a conference or a seminar, no official would ever turn up. They think it beneath their dignity to turn up at a conference or seminar to learn. And that's a big difference from other countries, as you pointed out, Korea. I was in Sri Lanka as the IMF rep. I arranged a conference on financial development or whatever. Yeah. That's a different story. But the interesting thing was three cabinet ministers actually sat there and listened to the whole thing and took notes and participated vigorously through 2 days of the conference. So, you know, it's a different structure. But let me see. It's very, very good of you. It's been a wonderful conversation. We have to do another one on a different subject. But before we go, I'd like to ask you a question that I think people benefit a lot from. Would you recommend a book or even a movie or whatever you like to students who might wish to educate themselves?
Well, I mean, I would say that anything on institutional development would be a good thing to do.
Any specific recommendation that you have?
Well, I mean, you know, I can think offhand of a book on Heba Handusa, and somebody edited this on institutional development for Egypt. But that's sort of restricted to Egypt's problem.
It doesn't matter for Pakistan, it should be very interesting. Can you tell us the name of it?
It's called Institutional Reform and Economic Development in Egypt. It's edited by Noha L. Mikawy, E-L-M-I-K-A-W-Y, and Heba Handusa. Heba is H-E-B-A, and Handusa is H-A-N-D-O-U-S-S-A, and it's published by the Economic Research Forum in Cairo.
Okay, got it. But very briefly, could you tell us why you think people should read this book?
Well, it will show them, you know, in a sense, it takes the importance of institutional development for granted. It assumes that we say that it's important. But then it gives examples from the Egyptian case of what's wrong with the with particular institutions and what could be done to fix them. So, you know, sort of, I think in Pakistan, there have been, you know, stuff done on different things. Civil service reform might be one. I mean, but I haven't seen anything really on the reform, let's say, of the commercial judicial system. I mean, I think it'd be worthwhile talking to some judges who worked on that matter to see what it is. Because the Egyptians had a major four-volume study done. The figures I gave you about the costs and the time length and so on came from a study done by Justice Bentley. It was financed by USAID and it was done in cooperation with Egyptian legal firms. And it was published in four volumes in about 1995 or 1996.
Great. Thank you very much. Khaled Sahib, thank you very much. It's been a wonderful conversation. I think we've learned a lot about not only the history of planning, but how planning should be done, how we should think about its evolution, and most importantly, the role of expertise and how to have a cerebral government full of expertise and capable of understanding the economy, the economic process, the policy process, economic reform. These are very big asks, and we should like to talk to you much more on this, but next time, inshallah.
Let me make just one final remark. Mm-hmm. which is that I said things which you may or may not have found useful, and it's very kind of you to say they were useful, but the really difficult job has been left to you and Pakistanis, which is to get a cerebral government in power.
Oh, that's something that you'll struggle for two generations more. Thank you, Khaled. Thank you.
All the best.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem Ul Haq hai.
Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.